collection that we are spending these tree outreach collections to support our UU Association's effort to get our name and message out before the American public by means of a pretty aggressive, we hope, marketing campaign. And yet I've noticed that whenever one of these let's get the word out on who we are type of conversations come up, that conversation can very quickly turn to how awkward and unwieldy the very name Unitarian Universalist is. That's a good point. I don't think there's another mainline denomination out there that requires 10 syllables just to speak its name. And besides that, so this critique, again, quite correctly goes, the very words Unitarian and Universalist don't hold the same meaning now that they did for our forebears who initially used them. So this line of argument goes, let's just shorten our name down to Unitarian and take it from there. And I guess from a strictly PR point of view, that's not such a bad idea. But when it comes to honoring and understanding and learning from the history and the tradition that have brought us here to this point, it's a not so good idea at all. For I am of the opinion, as supportive as I want to be of all the efforts that go into putting our name out there, I'm of the opinion that we're not going to experience too much significant growth as a liberal religious body as long as we remain confined within the demographic boundaries that we seem to have largely and inadvertently, I would say, for the most part, erected for ourselves. I'll say more on that in just a moment. But one starting point for at least looking beyond those boundaries is to gain a deeper appreciation for the universalist side of the story of our denominational family tree. I'm overdrawing this just a little bit, but sometimes it's good to think that the we are a tradition, a faith tradition of both the head and the heart. And like I said, I'm overdrawing this a little bit, but the Unitarian side of the family tends to represent the head piece of it, whereas the Universalists are more on the heart piece of it. And then you'll see that as I go along. As many of you know, our denomination is the result of a merger that took place in 1960 of the American Unitarian Association and the Universalist Church in America, both of which have been on this continent since the time of the founding of our nation itself. So I'm going to devote much of this sermon today to one of the major players in the founding of American Universalism, a fellow from the backwoods of New Hampshire. His name was Hosea Ballou. And I think I can safely say backwoods of New Hampshire because at the time of Mr. Ballou's birth in 1771 in Richmond, New Hampshire, backwoods was pretty much all there was to our fine state. Two quick backups here. This is my third UU Heritage Sunday sermon. One of the characteristics of our congregation is if you do something once and then decide to do it again, you have started an instant tradition. So my instant tradition for the last Sunday in October began 2 years ago when I did a sermon on the life and martyrdom of Michael Servetus, who was burned at the stake on October the 27th, which was yesterday, in his case, 1553, at the hands of John Calvin in Geneva, Switzerland, for challenging the doctrine of the Trinity. Well, that sermon on Servetus, I did it at the request of the highest bidder, or I think it was bidders, Steve LeDoux and, Jim McCroy, for the service auction sermon that Sunday, and seemed to go over pretty well, so I figured, well, I'll just keep a good thing going here by speaking about a prominent figure in our UU story on the fourth Sunday of every October. So I guess you're kind of stuck with that as long as I'm hanging around. And last year I did about Joseph Priestley, the Unitarian scientist and minister who brought Unitarianism to America. This year I'm going to move to the Universalist side with Hosea Bullock. My second backup. One of the reasons I chose this gentleman is because his life and ministry do present a challenge, or maybe they present a way of hope, to those demographic boundaries I just mentioned. For we Unitarian Universalists seem to have a hard time getting outside the box of being a well-educated, professionally oriented, reasonably financially comfortable, and mostly white bunch of folks. Now, as Jerry Seinfeld would say, Not that there's anything wrong with that. At least I hope there's nothing wrong with it, because I fall into all four of those categories. But we also, I think, severely limit ourselves on our message. That's the only box we live in. I don't have a chapter or verse solution to propose this morning as how we get out of those, beyond those class boundaries and biases. Granted, it's a conversation we seriously need to have. But all I can do today is point to a part of our story that tells how we did reach and operate well beyond those boundaries for a long time in bringing the message and hope of religious liberalism. These are some of the same boundaries, in fact, that Mr. Ballou, later Reverend Ballou, experienced in his ministry. For even after he got himself out of the backcountry of New Hampshire, and even after he changed his affiliation from being a Baptist minister, as was his father, to that of a Universalist, and even after he became, in 1817, and served there for about another 30 years, the minister of the quite large Second Universalist Church in Boston, he and his congregants remained on the lower rungs of the social ladder. The Universalist historian Ernest Cassera writes, "Hosea Ballou, with his backwards accent and meager formal education, was no social match for Dr. William Ellery Channing and the other Harvard-educated Unitarians who dominated the pulpits of Boston. Ballou's congregation was made up of humble folk who, although they were to make their way up the socioeconomic ladder to relative prominence during the period of Ballou's ministry, were not entertaining in the homes of the best families who filled the pews in the Unitarian churches." And then Cassera wryly adds, "It took great fortitude on Ballou's part not to become bitter when he observed the Unitarians, fellow believers in so many ways, doing oratorical gymnastics to keep from being identified with the Universalists." Well, okay, who was that? Who was that guy? I've given you some bits and pieces of his life. I'm going to fill in a little more now. Richmond, New Hampshire, which I don't believe I've ever visited, is a little ways to the west of here. It's about 20 miles south of Keene, just above the Massachusetts line. As noted, this was Ballou's birthplace, April 30th, 1771. He was quite literally a child of the American Revolution. His mother died before he was 2 years old, and young Jose formed a very strong attachment to his father, who would later remarry. His father, as noted, was a country Baptist preacher. The only formal education available to Hosea was 3 years in a one-room schoolhouse. It might have been schoolhouses, I don't know if he attended more than one. But that was enough to awaken in his mind a certain intellectual curiosity, to the point that he was able, after that, to self-educate himself, really for much of the rest, or all of the rest, of his life. His devotion to his father led him into the Baptist ministry, but just at the time, the newly introduced and quite liberalized form of Christianity called Universalism was making its inroads into the outposts of New England. Now, as is often the case, when a newly emerging religion is taking shape, there are any number of disagreements and disputes over what constituted true and right and real Universalism. This was the very same case in the first two or three centuries of Christianity before the Nicene Creed was adopted. But there was general agreement among that first generation of Universalists in America that God was primarily a God of love and compassion, as contrasted to the usually angry and vengeance-seeking God of the Calvinists. They further believed that this loving God would not punish people for all eternity for any sins they may have committed in a short and temporal life here on earth. They believed fervor in the existence of sin and evil, but they rejected the idea that sinfulness was a condition that we're born into with having no choice about it, as the doctrine of original sin teaches. These Universalists believed in the Christian God, they revered the Bible, they believed in the afterlife, but they rejected the predominantly Calvinist theology that was preached in the New England congregational churches of that time. In its first generation form, Universalism believed then that this loving God would eventually reconcile all souls unto himself. God was a he in those days. and that no one would suffer eternal punishment. Universal salvation, in other words. So for all their initial disagreements, the universalists were united on these major points. Yeah, that may sound a little quaint to us. I know it's outside the realm of thinking and believing that most of us here do today. But try to imagine, if you can, how good all that must have sounded, especially for those people toiling away in these little towns, villages, and farms of 18th and 19th century New England. These were people with very likely good minds, but like Mr. Ballou, very little formal education. And they were out there, just kind of busting their buns from daybreak to dark, just to eke out a living for themselves and their families. And then they go to church on Sunday, which is their one day off, and they hear a sermon, usually, about what a bunch of miserable sinners they are, and how mad God is at them for their sinfulness, and how Jesus had to die a horrible death on account of their sinfulness, and maybe, but only maybe, the horrible death that Jesus had to endure will mitigate God's wrath just enough so they might not have to suffer eternal punishment. You know, I can imagine some poor farmer sitting in his pew out there, thinking to himself, man, one day of the week I don't have to work like a dog and I got to sit here and listen to this. But religiously speaking, these simple, but by no means simple-minded people were not given any other religious alternative in the communities they were in except to not be religious at all, and given the climate of the times, that could get them into all sorts of trouble in their temporal life, never mind eternity. And then came the universalists with the message I just spoke of. And they came with their marching orders from the Reverend John Murray, the British-born founder of American Universalism, who had said, go out into the highways and byways of your new country, America. Give the people something of your vision. Give them not hell, but hope and courage. Preach the kindness and the everlasting love of God. And the individual then who took up Murray's call with the greatest level of devotion and dedication, along with his spiritual and intellectual vigor, was Hosea Ballou. For a while, Murray planted the seeds of universalism in this country and did found some universalist churches along the East Coast, and he did that while Ballou was still an infant. It was Hosea Ballou who actually nurtured and pruned and tended and kept that garden growing clear up until his death in 1852. By which time, universalism had become one of America's major Protestant denominations. Ballou served universalist congregations in Dana, Massachusetts, Bernard, Vermont, Portsmouth, New Hampshire, Salem, Massachusetts, before the 35 years that he spent at the Universalist Church in Boston, and that ministry ended when he died. And while serving those churches, he also became the major shaper, the major definer of both the theology and the structure of universalism for the first half of the 19th century. And one of the first attempts those universalists made to codify, which is to say to get down in writing, their still emerging vision and version of liberal universalist Christianity, was adopted at a gathering of those first generation of universalist ministers just to the west of here again, in a town called Winchester, New Hampshire, in 1803. So they called it, appropriately enough, the Winchester Profession. In one of my sillier moments, I once tried to figure out a way of doing a variation on the song Winchester Cathedral by substituting Winchester Profession. It didn't work out too well. That's a good thing. And Ballou, anyway, served on the committee that drafted this document. You're going to hear more about this next Sunday from John Sanders when we start a new round of outreach collections, and I don't want to steal any of this thunder today, except to say that there is a move, or has been a move, underway in our New Hampshire, Vermont district, soon to be the Northern New England district, that John's very much involved with, along with John LaSalle and Lee Page, to create a Universalist Heritage Center over in Winchester that will help keep this Universalist story alive. I hope you'll come back next Sunday to hear more about that. Okay, there are two Lou's legacy that I want to leave with you today. One I've been alluding to all along here this morning. Ballou and the early universalists clearly demonstrate that the message and the appeal of religious liberalism can cut well across class lines. As I said earlier, I don't have a magic, easy-to-implement formula for getting us out of the demographic box we seem to have, by and large, gotten ourselves into. But at least I think one helpful first step will be to recover and to celebrate that part of our story and that side of our family, of those universalists, largely under Ballou's guidance and inspiration, who were able to take their liberal faith to a very broad swath of the American population. In 1880, the Universalist Church of America, depending on who was counting, was either the fifth or sixth largest denomination in America. It's very important we keep our story in front of them today. For my own local scene, there was the Universalist Church here in New Hampshire, I think 6 years before, no, 8 years, 1818, 8 years before this church was founded. So they've been around a long time. The one other piece of Ballou's legacy I want to leave with you was his humanizing of Jesus. Right about the same time he was helping to draft the Winchester Confession, and he actually didn't have a whole lot to do with that because he was devoting much more of his energy to producing a document called A Treatise on the Atonement. Now, an act of atonement, as you probably know, is a deed that is done, a gesture made, something you do to make right an earlier misdeed. One of the highest holy days on the Jewish calendar is Yom Kippur, which means Day of Atonement. It's the time when persons of that faith are to make right any wrongs, misdeeds, or harm for which they feel they are responsible in the preceding year. And you know, I got to work a Red Sox reference in here somewhere. I didn't manage to say it till towards the end. I just want to point out that when J.D. Drew hit that grand slam home run against Cleveland in the sixth game of the American League Championship Series, it was an act of atonement. It was, for the disappointing, mediocre season he had had up to that point. With one atoning swing of the bat, he redeemed himself to the faithful of Red Sox Nation, and now you know what the theological implications of all that were. So, while the idea of atonement is a very sound one, recognized and practiced in one form or another in many religions, it had, as Ballou saw it, become perverted when applied to traditional Christian theology, which holds that Jesus' death on the cross was an act of atonement that he, Jesus, who was also God, had to take upon himself in a vicarious kind of a way to atone for and to save us all from our fallen nature. And I'm thinking there must have been something in that frontier, common-sense mind of his that led Ballou to think, this can't be right. So he put forth the idea that it was the life, the teachings, the example of Jesus who showed us how to live in such a way that we can turn away from the more shadow or fallen side of ourselves and live a redeemed or godly life. That, too, may sound a little quaint to us now, but it was a major statement at the time. For it took the emphasis off Jesus' death and put it on his life. And while Ballou and his followers did believe that Jesus was the divine Son of God, they stressed his humanity as the saving part of his ministry rather than his death. And while Ballou's liberal Christianity is no longer the central element of Unitarian Universalism today, by pointing to the humanity of Jesus and by holding up the idea that by following his example, we human beings can be our own atoners, as it were, by following that example of love and mercy and compassion and justice, it was Hosea Ballou who actually planted the very early seeds for the humanism that now largely does characterize our liberal religious movement today. So I give thanks to the life of this country preacher, who eventually worked his way to a very prominent pulpit in Boston. And while his homespun manner failed to impress the Unitarians who were all around him, in 19th century Boston, He left an impression all the same, one that we should take to heart, and we should remember him well, and we should honor his legacy. Let's sing together our closing hymn, "The Joy We Claim as a Growing Light." It is number 345.